talking to Pyongyang today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. North and South Korea are talking face-to-face again, but as this Korea expert will tell you from personal experience, negotiating with the North isn't easy.
While we're at the table, the North Koreans don't hesitate to remind me that our countries are actually still in a state of war and that technically I'm an enemy combatant.
Plus, a law in Germany punishes social media companies if they fail to remove fake news and hate speech from their platforms.
It puts these private companies in the place of courts trying to decide what German law means and apply it to German speakers.
Those stories and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. And this is the soundtrack to a possible breakthrough for peace. The Beatles' A Day in the Life, performed by guitarist Jeff Beck. It's a song the North Korean pair's figure skaters perform to. And in a few weeks at the Winter Olympics in South Korea, those two skaters will be on the ice. More about North Korea's pair's competitors in a few minutes. Those skaters are actually in the middle of some delicate negotiations between North and South Korea right now. For the first time in more than 2 years, both sides sat down for direct talks today. The World's Matthew Bell has been following the news, and he joins me now in the studio. How big a deal was this meeting today, Matthew?
As you mentioned, it's the first time North and South officials have sat down face-to-face in a couple of years. It comes at a time, of course, that tensions have been running very high, especially between North Korea and the United States. The other thing, Marco, is the two sides agreed to meet again and even talk about ways to reduce military tensions.
So it wasn't a one-off. We've been asking this question over and over again, Matthew. Here we go again. What does Kim Jong-un really want?
Well, according to the U.S. intelligence community, they say that Kim wants two things. He wants to stay in power, and he wants to keep his nuclear weapons. William Tobey of the Belfer Center at Harvard says that's a pretty solid assessment.
I think in this case, Occam's razor, looking for the simplest explanation, is probably the best one. If you look at what the regime values, it has always valued its hold on power.
But Tobey, who was a U.S. negotiator with North Korea in the second Bush administration, says Kim wants something more than just regime survival. He wants to change the status quo. He wants sanctions lifted against the DPRK. That's North Korea's official name, and wants to bring North Korea out of the shadows into the international community. Tobey says the regime sees one way to do that.
With nuclear weapons, it is possible that they will feel that they have more space to oppose the current state of affairs.
North Korean state media ran a commentary today that said the U.S. has a choice. Either continue its military standoff with the DPRK and meet its end, or coexist with North Korea, the fully fledged nuclear power.
We don't know what exactly they're going to attempt to do with their newfound nuclear power. We know that they've committed violent acts throughout their history. They've shot down aircraft, seized American ships, bombed the South Korean cabinet, bombed South Korean airliners, sent a terrorist attack against the Blue House, killing the wife of the president of South Korea. This is a troubling history.
But Tobey says we do know that in their worldview, the North Koreans are still fighting the Korean War, the one that started in 1950 when Kim Jong-un's grandfather invaded South Korea, and it never really ended. Propaganda from the North talks about reunifying the entire Korean peninsula under the leadership of the Kim dynasty. That would mean liberating South Korea and kicking out the Americans. But Suzanne DiMaggio says this is an open question for Kim Jong-un. She's with the New America Foundation, and she's been involved with semi-official negotiations with North Korean officials. DiMaggio says, we still don't know how far Kim is willing to go to get a peace treaty with the U.S. In other words, will he accept something short of final victory on the Korean Peninsula?
I think much has been made of the fact that the North Koreans would like to, one of the reasons they've gained this nuclear power is to reunify the peninsula on their terms. I don't think we have any solid evidence to back that claim up. It could be true, but it's something I think we would need to explore with them in talks to see what their point of view is.
When officials from the two Koreas met today, the issue of denuclearization was raised by the South. The head of the North Korean delegation said that's a non-issue because none of the North's missiles are aimed at brethren in South Korea. They're all aimed at America. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
As I mentioned earlier, there's a North Korean figure skating pair in the middle of all of this, Ryom Tae-ok and Kim Ju-sik. They'll be headed to South Korea next month to compete in the Winter Olympics, which should be interesting given the politically charged situation on the Korean Peninsula, as if the pressure of competing in the Olympic Games wasn't enough, right? Jeri Longman is with me. He's the New York Times sports reporter. And you've met Ryom Tae-ok and Kim Ju-sik. What are they like? Did they seem very different from other young skaters you've met and covered?
I met them at a skating competition in Germany in September where they qualified for the 2018 Olympics. And to be honest, no, they didn't seem that much different from any other skater. It's a niche world. They were embraced by the other skaters, and they spoke several times to reporters and seemed to be, you know, relatively open. And they seemed to make every effort to avoid politics. Mm-hmm. For instance, they didn't wear the pins that North Koreans commonly wear depicting Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il. They also, even more interestingly, did not praise Kim Jong-un for their success, which is a common practice among North Korean athletes. So they seem to make every attempt to just be about skating.
That's interesting. How much state support do these pair of skaters get?
You know, whatever support they have would be state support. They finished 15th at the World Figure Skating Championships last March in Helsinki. So they are elite world-class skaters. They won't win a medal in these Olympics, but they are, you know, they won't embarrass themselves either. And they were sent over the summer to train with a Canadian pairs coach in Montreal. So it's clear that the North Koreans spent the time and effort in an attempt to qualify for the Olympics.
And what kind of pressures do you think they are under to perform well at this high-profile event at the Olympics, and one that's been heralded as a diplomatic breakthrough now?
You know, it's a good question. I just talked to Bruno Marcotte, the Canadian coach who has worked with them, and his thinking is that they would only be under the same pressure that every other skater in the world is, and that's to, you know, perform at your best.
I mean, we do have a lot of preconceptions when it comes to life in North Korea, and one that it is very isolated, but athletes do need to compete internationally. They do need to travel. So are Ryom and Kim isolated? Do they have minders when they travel?
They were traveling in a party for the Olympic qualifying with a coach and an official from the Skating Federation. But, you know, I saw them a couple of times coming in and out of the building by themselves in this small Bavarian town in Germany, just a little village. And they were walking around without the minders. I mean, they probably were only getting on a bus back to the hotel or walking maybe the streets for a minute of this tiny village. But, yeah, they're fairly well isolated.
I also saw that at the competition in Germany in September, they skated to the Beatles tune A Day in the Life performed by Jeff Beck, which is not exactly what you think about when you think North Korea. It's actually a pretty sophisticated selection. Was it their choice or some coach's choice?
You know, that's unclear. Actually, when the Associated Press asked them about this at the World Championships, it ended the interview immediately.
But really? The Beatles are still that controversial.
But so there's a lot of different influence in their skating. So they have a kind of dynamism of the Chinese skaters. They appear to be following the Chinese model of building the pair skaters up to elite level. They have a kind of classic balletic style reminiscent of the Russians. But they do, as you say, they have this Western influence.
Does this moment recall for you, Jeri, any other sports moments when athletes had to compete under the usual pressure, but then there was added this kind of geopolitical pressure as well?
Well, you know, during the Cold War period, obviously, the Soviet Union and the former East Germany both used the Olympics as a, you know, a real propaganda to show the value of communism. There, according to Bruno Marcotte, the Canadian coach I spoke to, he doesn't sense that same importance, especially for Winter Olympics for North Korea. They've only ever won two medals in the Winter Olympics, both in speed skating and none since 1992. So I don't think it holds the same sort of propaganda value, we could say, that it did for the Soviet Union and East Germany. But clearly, you know, North Korea doesn't want to send athletes who will perform badly. And the history of this pair is that they won't perform badly.
Jerry Longman, sports reporter for The New York Times, thanks very much.
Thank you.
All right, serious topic switch now. Researchers have uncovered something enormous this week, something mysterious, previously unknown. It is a number, but not just any number. I'm talking about a prime number. Remember math class, everyone? Prime numbers are ones which cannot be divided by any other number except themselves and 1, 2, 3, and 5, for example. And the number found this week, it is the largest known prime number to date, like really, really, really large. Marcus de Sautoy is Simonia Professor for the Public Understanding of Science at Oxford University. He says primes are fascinating and elusive.
We know that there are infinitely many of these numbers since the ancient Greeks, but the great puzzle is, where are they? There seems to be no pattern to help us to find them. And so every time we find a new one which beats the current record, it makes the news.
All right. I actually have in front of me the file with the number itself written out. It crashed my producer's computer earlier when he first pasted it into Word, and I don't know how many digits it is, but I'll tell you, it's got 13,000 plus pages to it. So I can't even like see the numbers if I scroll up because it wants the memory can't catch up fast enough. Wow, it's incredible.
Yeah, you don't want to be reading that out aloud now because it's got 23,249,425 digits, which will take you about 3 months, I think,
wow,
to read aloud.
So. 23 million plus.
So this is an enormous number.
So how did whoever found this number, how did they find it?
Well, what's intriguing about this story is that it isn't a research mathematician. It isn't a huge, great big Cray computer or something like this. It was actually an amateur using his laptop and using a piece of software that actually anyone can download from the internet who discovered this. And he'd been working for 14 years actually trying to see whether he could find one of these kind of gems. I mean, they were a bit like diamonds amongst this kind of chaos of numbers. It's about the great act of discovering something fundamental about the universe.
And what about practical uses of having this massive prime number?
Well, I wouldn't say there's much practical use of this particular prime number. It's a bit like a sports car going faster and faster actually helps you to develop new techniques for more mundane cars. But primes themselves are absolutely fundamental to our modern age. Anyone who sends their credit card across the internet is using prime numbers to keep that credit card secure. So understanding these primes is really essential to e-commerce.
And do these large prime numbers help at all to put the universe into kind of less chaos?
Well, I would say the real challenge is not understanding individual primes, but understanding the infinity of primes all in one go. For me, this is a bit like somebody singing a very high note, but actually we want to hear how all the notes of the primes are put together and to understand the music. And that's the great unsolved problem of mathematics.
So when was the last time the previously large prime number was discovered?
Well, the last record was in 2015, September 17th. So if I was going to make a prediction, which partly mathematics is all about trying to spot patterns, I would say maybe we have to wait to 2000 and maybe 19, 20 to have the next discovery. But that's the wonderful thing about these numbers. You never quite know when the next one's going to appear.
Marcus de Sautoy, Oxford University Simonia Professor for the Public Understanding of Science. I understand primes a little bit better now, thanks to you. Thank you very much.
Great. Well, good luck with your own search.
Coming up, tackling fake news and hate speech in Germany. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with the world. Content, they say, is king, but the way Germany sees it, there's some content online that doesn't deserve its place on the throne. A new law in Germany will fine social media companies up to $60 million per violation if they don't promptly take offensive material off their platforms. That includes hate speech and fake news. The law applies to companies that have more than 2 million users in Germany, so think Facebook, think Twitter. And since the law went into effect last week, the ensuing conversation shows us some of the tension between holding social media companies accountable for content on their platforms and allowing users to post freely on those platforms. To break this all down, I've got two guests with me. Lisa Maria Neudert is with the Oxford Internet Institute, where she researches propaganda, social bots, and fake news. And Emma Alonso is with the Center for Democracy and Technology, a nonprofit headquartered in Washington with offices in Brussels. So, Emma Alonso, let me start with you, because your organization, the Center for Democracy and Technology, was in touch with the German government as it was crafting this legislation. Under this law, social media companies have 24 hours to take down, quote, blatantly illegal hate speech after it's been flagged. So what constitutes blatantly illegal hate speech, and who defines that?
That's a really good question. So the companies under this law are tasked with enforcing over 20 different provisions of the German Criminal Code, which include prohibitions against hate speech, but also defamation, insult, defamation of religion, a number of different parts of the German Criminal Code that prohibit different kinds of speech or expression. The real challenge for social media company is going to be figuring out exactly what amounts to a violation of German law. That's not something that private companies are well equipped to do, and it's certainly not the role that they're supposed to play in a rule of law system.
So how has the law played out so far? Like, have we seen posts that qualify as hate speech that have been taken down?
Yes, there were some high-profile takedowns where both a politician from one of the far-right parties in Germany had tweets that were very kind of disparaging of Muslims taken down from Twitter and similar posts from Facebook. But then also a satirical magazine, The Titanic, that was kind of parodying this politician's nasty, vituperative comments, also found their posts taken down. And the social media companies have gotten criticism from the left and the right in Germany for their takedowns of both of these.
So apparently the companies have not confirmed that they've removed the content due to this new law.
Right. And so that's one of the challenges that this law really puts to all of us in the public trying to understand what's affecting the information that we see on social media. When you have these kind of private enforcement systems set up, as we see under the German law, there's really not that opportunity for holding the government accountable for treating speech as illegal. They've sort of put that burden on the companies and taken themselves out of the mix in a way that means that people can't hold the government to account for deciding that their speech, their ideas, their views actually violates the law.
So defining hate speech is kind of a murky area. Lisa Maria Neudert with the Oxford Internet Institute, let me bring you in here. How does this law apply to fake news? Because that category seems even harder to define than hate speech.
Absolutely. The satire magazine Titanic that Emma has mentioned, when we're talking about fake news, one of the discussion points is exactly, should satire, something like Titanic, something like The Onion, be regarded as fake news? There are a couple of people that say, no, absolutely, this is not fake news. This is clearly satire. But then there's also other people that are saying, well, this can easily become fake news simply if we are talking to people that are not educated enough to distinguish between satire and distinguish between news. And I think those are all big questions that we right now don't have a proper answer to. And all of a sudden, the people that are now in charge of finding those answers are the social media companies.
So you research fake news, Lisa Maria, or junk news, as some call it. You call it computational propaganda. What do you make of this German law?
Well, I think what I like about this German law is that when we're addressing issues of junk news, of computational propaganda, a lot of the times the narrative is that we cannot regulate social media companies, and we also cannot put social media companies in a position where they are accountable. And I think this law definitely shows that it is possible to regulate social media companies, even though they are those big transnational companies.
Lisa Maria, would this law affect content that originates from Germany only, or could something like posted by a U.S. user, for example, that reaches German users, could that be taken down?
I think it is my impression that if we have – for example, comments that are originating from a U.S. user but are under a German media publication, then that would also be subject to the law. But this is also exactly one of the slippery slopes you are pointing out with this. We all of a sudden have that global internet and now have a regional law, and we now have questions that we have never seen in that form before.
For both of you, I got to say, it's kind of weird that we're talking about two things, hate speech and fake news, that don't necessarily feel similar, but are they now similar? And are we talking about them together because of the internet and how it accelerates the exchange of ideas? And prior to the internet, I mean, they both existed, obviously, but did they have a common denominator, hate speech and fake news?
So I think what unites them, or why we're talking about them at the same time right now, is really because they fall under this broader umbrella of quote unquote problematic content that is much more viewable and visible on social media platforms. But, you know, I think the kind of the solutions for how to deal with the existence of something like fake news or disinformation in society and what to do about hate speech may in fact be very different. You know, if we're looking at how to help people understand the difference between satire and real news reporting, that's a media literacy and education kind of issue. And I worry that something like this German law is really just reflective of policymakers not knowing what to do about the very high visibility of so much nasty or concerning content on the internet and deciding that censorship is really the best answer and not addressing the root causes of these problems.
I'm a little bit more conflicted about that. So I think while this law is very possibly overblocking, I also think that for the problems at hand that we now have with fake news, with hate speech, those are problems that are so pressing. They have a real-time impact, and especially we see them being used as propaganda. We see Russian election hacking. We see people using the online space to manipulate people for referenda, for elections. And I think when we're talking about education as a possible solution, yes, that is wonderful and one very important way to empower people to really tackle those issues. But the problem is that it's also a very long-term solution, and we really also need measures that are aiming at a much more short-time horizon with this.
Lisa Maria Neuder with the Oxford Internet Institute and Emma Lonso with the Center for Democracy and Technology. Thank you both very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman. President Trump is stopping temporary protected status for Salvadorans in the U.S., and that could spell the end of the American dream for thousands of families.
They allow us make a life here. 17 years, and now suddenly they just gonna take everything away from you.
One family story that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. El Salvador may be small, but over the years it's had a big impact on the U.S. We'll look back at American involvement in El Salvador's civil war in a few minutes. But first, let's focus on the situation facing about 200,000 Salvadorans currently living in the U.S. Many of them came here in 2001 after two massive earthquakes devastated their country. The U.S. government gave them temporary protected status, or TPS. It's allowed those immigrants to live and work in the U.S. legally. They've had children here who are now U.S. citizens. But yesterday, the Trump administration announced that it's ending TPS for Salvadorans, and that means many of them will have to either go back or face deportation. The World's Monica Campbell spoke with one family that could be affected. Monica, tell us who you met yesterday.
I met the Velasco family. They live in Brentwood, California, about an hour outside San Francisco. It's a pretty rural area, kind of if you're middle class, you can afford a home with a few rooms in it. And I met Vanessa and Enrique. They're parents in their late 30s. They're from El Salvador, and they have three kids, all U.S. citizens, 4, 12, and 17. Ariana, a high school senior. And they came to the U.S. on tourist visas back in 2000. Gang violence was getting worse in El Salvador. They were interested in what life was like in the United States. And then, as we know, in 2001, a series of huge earthquakes struck El Salvador, and the U.S. government offered Salvadorans a chance to live here, refuge. And that is the program as we know today called Temporary Protected Status. The father, Enrique, says that they went for that program. They applied for it.
We left the country knowing that it was a bad situation already there. After the earthquake, the government announced that they were going to give this temporary status. And yes, I mean, we decided to take it, to apply for it.
And then you had kids.
Yes. I mean, they all born here. You know, always we heard here talking about a possibility of some kind of legalization and a reform on the immigration. And we were hoping that something was going to happen.
So, Monica, how did it seem like the Velascos were dealing with this news from the Trump administration yesterday?
Well, you know, over the years, they've renewed their TPS status since 2003. But they have noticed, obviously, that under the Trump administration, there's been a real crackdown on unauthorized immigration. And they have been watching very closely how the administration has also been taking on legal immigrants. So they told me that they weren't surprised. They've been on watch since Trump got elected.
And what about their children, especially the high school senior, Ariana?
She may be the one that is left behind if her parents have to go back because she has two young siblings. But she's a high school senior and she's applying for colleges here, including UC Berkeley. And so there's a reality here that she could be left alone in the United States and see her family go back to El Salvador. And this is what she told me.
It's for real. I realize, you know, I got to be strong during this point. You know, I have to continue in my studies to be able to provide for myself and also help them wherever they will be.
What about conversations that her parents have had, like with their neighbors? What have those been like?
I mean, like I said earlier, the family, the Velascos, they live about an hour or so away from San Francisco. It's a very rural part of California, farmland. And, you know, Trump clearly lost California, but in this part of California, he actually took about 30% of the vote compared to single digits in places like San Francisco. So the Velascos know people who voted for Trump. And so this is what they told me when it came to conversations that they'd had with their neighbors.
We could see a lot of signs supporting Trump around here, especially the farms.
Yes, and they were surprised because they never thought we were in jeopardy. They always tell us, you are the good ones. You don't have to be worried about it.
You're the good ones.
Yeah. You are not. Yeah. You are here with the program.
But they saw that we were worried.
Wow. What about the criticism that this is temporary status, but if you've had it for nearly 20 years, it seems permanent?
You know, it's interesting when I was talking to Enrique Velasco. I mean, he watches CNN. When I walked into the house, they were watching CNN, but he also watches Fox. He listens to conservative talk radio, and they know the debate. Those against it say, you know, they've overstayed their visas, they've built lives here, but the reason for allowing them to remain in the country to begin with is no longer a reason anymore. And in this case, in El Salvador, Department of Homeland is saying that the reason for this program no longer exists. And I asked the Velascos about this, and here's what they said.
For me, the bottom line is, if you see the numbers, most of us are working here, contributing. We are not burdening the system.
They allow us make a life here. 17 years of a legal life, giving to the economic of this country.
17 years of a legal life.
And now suddenly they're just going to take everything away from you.
This announcement, though, on no TPS, I mean, it's a real dilemma for families like the Velascos. How do they see their options?
They have some options. In their particular case, I mean, they could try for asylum of some sort. That's always tough. Asylum is really hard to get. But if they get a really skilled lawyer, if they can afford that, maybe they could try for some sort of political asylum. Some people with TPS may be able to get a green card through a U.S. citizen spouse or a child. That's not the case for the Velascos. Their oldest child is 17 years old. You have to be 21 to sponsor somebody for a green card if you're a U.S. citizen. So that's too long of a wait for them. One option is to stay and become undocumented and risk deportation anyway. You know, this is a really hard thing for families to talk about. And this is something that Enrique told me about that September 2019 deadline.
It's going to go fast. We're going to be counting every month. put everything in order at the same time that we are hoping that something changes.
Yesterday when I was at their house, I mean, it was somber. It was busy. They were fielding a lot of text messages from family in El Salvador asking them what they were going to do. I think it's just so hard to imagine for so many people in the United States to be facing this type of crossroads.
The World's Monica Campbell, thanks very much for telling us the Velasco story.
You're welcome, Marco.
America's involvement in El Salvador goes back decades. During the Cold War years of the 1980s, El Salvador is ripped apart by a brutal civil war. U.S.-backed government forces against leftist rebels who were supported by Cuba and the Soviet Union. And this next story is about one of the most successful and ruthless Salvadoran military commanders. My BBC colleague Mike Lanchon begins in 1984 in the heat of battle.
At the forefront of this battle, a 44-year-old army officer dressed in jungle fatigues and a floppy green army hat. He was El Salvador's best-known military commander.
Domingo Monterrosa was a rising star. He was creative, he was audacious, aggressive, capable. He was really a very effective commander.
Paolo Luaz, originally from Germany, spent 12 years with the Salvadoran rebels on the opposite side of the civil war to Colonel Monterrosa.
He was trained in the United States, and he took over the first counterinsurgent battalion formed. He was a real threat for us.
The 1980s marked the height of the Cold War between the US and the Soviet Union. El Salvador, along with Nicaragua, was on the front line of President Ronald Reagan's battle to contain communism in Central America.
Must we sit by while independent nations of this hemisphere are integrated into the most aggressive empire the modern world has seen?
At Reagan's urging, millions of dollars were being poured into arming and training the Salvadoran military in its fight against the Cuban and Soviet-backed rebels.
I don't believe there's a majority in the Congress or the country that counsels passivity, resignation, defeatism in the face of this challenge to freedom and security in our own hemisphere.
The Salvadoran army was just like all Latin armies, completely corrupt band of mediocrities. And so the guerrillas ran circles around them, and Monterrosa was the first exception to that rule.
James LeMoyne is a former New York Times correspondent in El Salvador.
I came to admire him among Salvadoran officers. For instance, most Salvadoran officers are just horrible with their men. When there was combat, hopped in a hole and let them do the fighting and dying. He wasn't like that at all. He led from the front. He took incredible care of his men. They hugely respected him. There was something, you know, admirable about that.
Admiral, perhaps, in his treatment of his own troops, but Colonel Monterrosa had a reputation for ruthlessness in his treatment of those he suspected of siding with the guerrillas. In December of 1981, troops under his command had rounded up and killed some 800 men, women and small children in a village called El Mosote, one of the worst civilian massacres of the war. Several years later, James LeMoyne and other journalists witnessed firsthand the aftermath of another brutal anti-guerrilla operation by Monterrosa's troops.
A friend of mine and I went to the northern part of Salvador on the advice of a priest friend, a Jesuit priest who was running a refugee area. And we went up there, and, you know, it's really out of Apocalypse Now, or, you know, it was just full of children, orphans, many of them who had just arrived that day or the day before. And a lot of them had survived or run away from a Monterrosa sweep. It was just absolutely overwhelming to have, you know, kids completely traumatized with nuns and priests trying to take care of them, nobody else really giving a damn. First they're terrified, then they desperately want to sit in your lap and just be held, and, you know, it's humanly overwhelming. And so I was really angry, and and I asked to see Monterrosa, and we just hammered him. You know, what are you doing? For God's sake, stop. And he at first denied it, then he winced, and I said, just stop killing civilians.
And what happened the next time you saw him?
A couple of weeks later, I got a call from Monterrosa saying, oh, you know, I have something I want to show you and talk to you about. Come out and see me. So we went, and he was classic Monterrosa, boots on his desk, and he picked up the phone and talked to somebody, and a few minutes later, there's a knock on the door, and a little orderly came in with two, you know, very scared little peasant children. Then he said, we had this, you know, big combat, and I was able to save these two children. And I said, well, what about their parents? And Monterrosa, complete deadpan, said, unfortunately, they died in crossfire.
Such terror tactics did in many ways succeed in undermining civilian support for the insurgents, but it also hardened the resolve of those opposed to the military, and it made Colonel Monterosa the number one target for the guerrillas. But the rebels' problem was how to get close to him. Paolo Lures, who we heard from earlier, worked with the rebels' clandestine radio station, Radio Venceremos, broadcasting on a crackly shortwave signal from rebel-held areas.
Radio Venceremos.
The radio was a potent symbol of the rebels' ability to outwit the army, and it irked Colonel Monterosa. He openly bragged about how he personally would silence it. Paolo Lures says it became an obsession for the colonel.
We were talking a lot about that. Somebody said, OK, we're going to give him what he wants. And then we formed the plan. Always when there were a military operation, he personally took with him some kind of trophy which he could show around and would have in his office. And the main trophy for him would be to capture the transmitter of the radio.
The plan was to leave an old rebel radio transmitter, booby-trapped with explosives, for Monterosa's troops to find. In October of 1984, the army launched a major offensive into rebel-held territory in the east. It was a perfect opportunity for the rebels to try out their plan. As the army advanced, Paolo listened in to the military's communications.
They found the device, and then they called it back to their commander, Monterosa. And Monterosa said, "Don't move anything. I'm coming, right now."
Monterosa immediately flew into the war zone to view his prize trophy. He held a press conference there, boasting about capturing what he thought was the guerrillas' radio equipment.
We were sort of praying, okay, what is he going to do with it, no? And I remember I said, he's going personally. He's going to take this in his helicopter. That's his trophy. This whole story is about that.
Paolo and the others were too far away to see what happened next. But within minutes of taking off, the bomb inside the transmitter detonated, and they realised that they'd succeeded in striking a deadly blow to their bitter enemy.
There was a big traffic going on, that asking for additional helicopters, asking for rescue.
Do you remember what the atmosphere was like at the guerrilla camps?
We were totally out of mind, you know, that this crazy plan really had worked.
It was a devastating blow, and it was one of the most brilliant counterinsurgency operations by the guerrillas of the war. I mean, that was a hammer blow.
I mean, the government's version immediately, obviously, was that it was mechanical problems.
No, complete rubbish. No, no. Well, I had Salvadoran people who were there who told us it blew to pieces. I mean, it disintegrated.
14 people died when Colonel Monterosa's helicopter exploded in midair. Monterosa himself was buried with all the ceremony of a state funeral, attended by the Salvadoran president and even the US ambassador to El Salvador. 8 years later, in 1992, a peace deal brought the war to an end. The rebels entered mainstream politics, and in 2009, they won the presidency. Colonel Domingo Monterosa is still revered by his army colleagues as a hero.
What a tale. The BBC's Michael Anshin there with the story of Colonel Domingo Monterosa. Thanks to our friends at BBC's Witness Program for that story. Cancer is not the unavoidable killer that it used to be. Take lung cancer in men, for example. In many parts of the world, deaths peaked in the late 1970s and early 80s. And for the most part, numbers have dropped or flattened out since then. Still, the planet's population continues to grow and to age. And that means millions of new cancer cases globally in the coming years. So imagine you hear about new and innovative cancer treatments, but you're also told you can't travel to the country that offers them. Some people wouldn't take no for an answer. That's the case with Americans who are continuing to trek to Cuba to get immunotherapy for lung cancer with vaccines not approved for treatment in the U.S. Correspondent Sally Jacobs recently traveled to Cuba to meet some of those patients who are seeking treatment. I asked her what the Cubans were offering.
There are a pair of vaccines, one called Simovax and the other called Vaxzera. They're part of a new wave of immunotherapies that trigger the patient's immune system to fight the cancer. Simovax, for example, blocks a protein that the cancer needs to continue. It basically starves that cancer. And Vaxzera operates similarly, but in a little bit of a different manner.
How does the global scientific community feel about this? Are they convinced these treatments are effective? Do they work?
There's a very mixed feeling about it. Some are quite positive, very curious about it, given that there has been a clinical trial in Havana that looks somewhat promising and appears to extend life by 3 to 5 months. So they're waiting the outcome of a clinical trial that's now underway at the Roswell Park Cancer Institute. But more common, I find, is a kind of a skepticism. Mm. They're not that confident in it.
So, Sally, you actually went to Cuba. You interviewed patients and doctors and scientists. I'd like you to introduce us to one of the people you met, a man by the name of George Keyes. He's a Colorado realtor and a grandfather. Tell us what his situation is.
So George Keyes has had cancer for just about 2.5 years now. He's undergone a series of treatments. Some work for a while, but eventually they stop working. He became curious about Simovax because there's a lot of attention to it in the media out there. He tried to get in the Roswell Park clinical trial. He was put on the wait list. And as he says, I got tired of waiting. I said, I'm going to the head of the line. I'm going to Cuba. And he basically wrote to the clinic there, got himself accepted, and he flew, as you could do back then, to Cuba and got the treatment, started it then. So he's on Vaxzera now and waiting to see. He's quite optimistic about it.
All right. Let's hear a bit of your conversation with George Keyes.
I'm not looking to break the law, but I'm not looking to die either because of, you know, regulations that have very little logic, to be honest. You should be allowed to do whatever you want to do to save yourself. And I intend to do that. You know, I don't intend to end up in jail. I mean, I'll try to follow the law as much as possible, but I'm not a stupid person either. And I think that it's just, it's tragic that people, tons of people out there with stage 4 cancer. I would say that the Vaxzera vaccine or some vaccine doesn't maybe work for everyone. But of everyone that's out there, in my heart, I believe that there's a percentage of those that would benefit greatly from being on this vaccine.
So as you said, Sally, George Keyes there, he got at the front of the line and went down to Cuba. Some of these Americans don't tell their U.S. doctors they're going to Cuba for treatment. What did this patient, George Keyes, do?
Right. A lot of patients don't tell because they're afraid their doctor won't treat them anymore. In George's case, he did tell his oncologist because he really likes him a lot and respects him. And his doctor told him not to go. He said, I don't know what you're going to get there. I don't know where you're going to get it. But George went anyway. You know, his doctor continues to treat him, but he did advise him not to go.
There are a lot of U.S. physicians, though, who are even more skeptical about the vaccines in Cuba. You spoke with Dr. Robert Dobell, a professor of medical oncology at the University of Colorado, and he said many doctors who treat lung cancer patients are frustrated by their patients' unrealistic expectations for the Cuban vaccines. Here's what he told you.
All of us have this similar experience of having to spend a lot of time in clinic discussing a treatment that really probably shouldn't be an option for our patients at this point in time. It's still investigational. And the trials that have been run so far have a modest effect in lung cancer patients, and they've not been replicated elsewhere outside of Cuba. I think most lung cancer experts believe that this is oversold.
I hear George Keyes actually brought an oncologist with him to Cuba.
He wasn't actually an oncologist. He was a family practitioner, an internist. He was very interested in the treatment. Mm. And he was very taken by what he saw in Havana, very impressed. He says, if I had stage 4 lung cancer, I would go there and get one of the Cuban vaccines. So that's quite a different medical view than George Keyes' own oncologist, who says, don't go there.
So, Sally Jacobs, how many Americans are using these Cuban-made vaccines? Do we know a number?
That's a great question. We don't really know the number. A lot of Americans who go there do not declare – well, most don't declare it. They don't tell when they're getting a visa, and they don't tell when they bring it back. There's a lot of talk about this in social media amongst patients. They talk about everything. How do you get to Cuba? How do you bring it back? What kind of refrigerated box do you need? There's a lot of talk. There's a lot of interest.
How has the recent Trump White House rollback of travel to Cuba and kind of reversing the thaw that Obama started in 2014, how has that impacted these patients?
What the Trump changes have done is make it harder to go there. In the Obama era, you could pretty much go there under the people-to-people category as you wished. You could book your own travel, get a visa from the airline, and pretty much do what you wanted there. Trump has changed everything. There is a people-to-people category, but you can't go on your own anymore under that category. You have to go with an organization and have a guide. guide and keep a full roster of activities during your time there. There are a couple ways you can go on your own. Professional research, that's the way George Keyes is going to go, and support for the Cuban people. But the general feeling is that there's going to be a lot more scrutiny, that customs is going to be watching when you come back in. So patients are quite anxious.
Let's hear from one last patient that you met in Cuba, Nancy Kelly. She's 71 years old, living in California, and she's got lung cancer. And she traveled to Cuba for the Vaxzira vaccine last spring. And she's really frustrated that the new Cuba travel restrictions might prevent her from making another trip.
I think it's absolutely outrageous. And I think the restrictions that do not permit doctors in different countries to corroborate, to help save lives, is absolutely terrible.
So, Sally, I recall right after Obama announced the thaw with Cuba in 2014, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo was practically on the next plane down with researchers and scientists to make deals. Is there a connection to the Buffalo Trials, and what is that collaboration all about?
Yes, they worked for many years to come up with the deal that would allow this to happen. I think in 2011, scientists from Roswell started going there. The trial began January of 2017. It's going to take several years, but it's immensely popular amongst patients, many of whom want to get into it. Many of them get turned down for, you know, many reasons, like George Keyes. But yes, it's something that many people are watching.
Mm. And are U.S. lung cancer patients clamoring to participate in those trials?
Yes. There's a social website where many cancer patients talk called Inspire. And there's a whole long conversation about it. How do you go? How do you get to Cuba? Many of them are ones who've been turned down, like George. Well, he was on the wait list. But yeah, for some, going to Cuba is a last prayer to go. And that's why George Keyes said, look, if we're about to die from lung cancer, why can't we try whatever we want if it's a possibility? And that's a good question.
Correspondent Sally Jacobs recently traveled to Cuba to meet Americans receiving immunotherapy for lung cancer. Her trip was supported with a grant from the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Great to see you again, Sally. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Sally's story is part of our Global Post Investigations Project. You can read her reporting at PRI.org. And that's all from us today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio, WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Hope you'll make it back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.